So I'm going to, I should put on the table right now that I'm not going to engage in a detailed comparison of Aquinas and Freud. I'm not a Freud scholar, so I'm not going to be saying anything about how one should or should not interpret Freud tonight. What I want to do is think about a particular idea that Freud brings, a particular human phenomenon that Freud brings to our attention, and see if Aquinas has the resources to deal with that phenomenon in his theory of psychology. So let's consider the following case. Of Victor. Victor works 80 hours a week in a senior position at an American bank. Although he frequently complains about how overworked he is and talks longingly about having a vacation, even planning out getaways with his wife, somehow the plans never materialize. Every time a trip must be put off, there's a concrete reason. He had hoped to take his wife to Paris in April, but now a new employee needs to be trained, and later this summer it will be impossible to get away with the roof being redone. Eventually, Victor's wife has had enough and furiously accuses him of not wanting to go on vacation. Victor is surprised and angry. Of course he wants a vacation. Hasn't he said so 1,000 times? It's not his fault that his plans always keep getting derailed. Later, however, he is haunted by his wife's accusation. Could he really be unconsciously avoiding time away from work rather than being the victim of unfortunate coincidences? But if that's what he's doing, why is he doing it? He runs through some possibilities. Am I trying to impress my boss? Am I afraid of my subordinate taking my job? Am I afraid of repeating that one terrible childhood vacation just before my parents broke up? Still trying to prove to my father that I'm not always the failure that he said I was? Am I afraid to let myself enjoy anything? Is a conversation that many academics can have with themselves when they find themselves in their office on yet another Saturday evening. Now notice that Victor does not derive this list of hidden motives from any first-person perspective of being so motivated. In reflecting, he's not able to discern introspectively whether it does in fact have such desires and beliefs. It occurs to him to consider this series of possible motives only because he's been culturally habituated to expect that human beings can be unconsciously motivated, and to expect that unconscious motivation is likely to explain certain kinds of strange behavior. And that Victor's self-interrogating doesn't seem strange or unfamiliar to us, I think, is a testimony to Freud's pervasive cultural influence. Of course, it's a very old idea that an agent's intentions might be opaque to herself. So, for instance, we all know about Socrates saying that the unexamined life is not worth living. Augustine in the Confessions asks himself why he stole the pears. He's not sure. We can think of Ignatius of Loyola's spiritual exercises, which are meant in part to reflect on one's own activities and why one does what one does. So the theme of self-opacity, so this idea that the human being's actions and motives might in fact be not fully transparent to the agent herself, is widely discussed in the classical tradition prior to Freud. But with Freud and the schools of professional psychological practice that arose in his wake, a much more radical notion enters our public discourse, namely that underneath the pleasing veneer of our conscious lives, there exists a whole shadow realm of unconscious motives, which might run completely opposite to our conscious narrative about why we act the way we do, and which are not discoverable by ordinary reflection and introspection. This deeper realm is ruled, we assume, by an uglier, more sinister version of me. Now, few people now accept Freud's thesis that we all harbor some sort of desire for incestuous sex and parent killing. But we're still very ready to point to unconscious motivations to explain other kinds of dark and self-destructive impulses. For instance, the person who systematically sabotages friendships that she claims to cherish. Or the boss whose secret self-doubt leads to bullying an employee. Or the person who professes to be committed to racial equality yet engages in discriminatory behavior. And I think this is part of the kind of public discourse that we have around implicit bias. So I want to emphasize, I'm just describing how popular psychology has taken up Freud's ideas, so I'm not making a claim about exactly how Freud wanted things to be interpreted. But I'm more interested here in the phenomenon that Freud identified that we've culturally come to take for granted. And it seems to us now perfectly normal for Victor to engage in the kind of self-questioning that he does about motives that he can't discover within himself. So I think Freud was able to highlight an important and distressing phenomenon that had largely been glossed over in previous philosophical psychology. There are some cases in which one could make sense of a particular human behavior if one attributed to the agent a certain kind of motive. But the agent, from a first-person perspective, cannot discover within herself having that motive, in fact, or any sort of corresponding belief, even. So I think that although Freud was right to identify the phenomenon, the explanation that he proposes is problematic. His conclusion is that there is an unconscious realm, or as some interpreters describe it, a kind of mindedness that has its own interpretations of reality and its own desires, living its own mind life apart from our conscious mind life. So what I want to do tonight is turn to a thinker who doesn't believe in an unconscious, Thomas Aquinas, and see whether his anthropology might provide any resources for analyzing the complexities of human motivation that Freud brings to our attention. And what I'm going to suggest is that even though Aquinas denies that we have any conscious or any cognitive activities, whether desiring or believing, that are unconscious activities, so he thinks all of our mental activities are conscious activities, nonetheless, the way he thinks about dispositions or tendencies of imagination give him the resources to be able to give quite a sophisticated account of what is happening in these kinds of scenarios. And I hope, as part of a bigger project of exploring Aquinas' theory of imagination as a kind of neglected part of his psychology, and show just how powerful this cognitive power is in shaping our embodied lives as intellectual creatures. So what I'm going to do is first take a bit of a closer look at the philosophical difficulty that's posed by unconscious motivation cases, such as Victor's, and identify some analyses of how we could go about thinking about this particular kind of case and why it sets up a kind of problem that's philosophically interesting. Then I'm going to look a little bit at some principles of Aquinas' psychology, and particularly looking at his animal psychology, which carries over to his child psychology in interesting ways, and point out some relationships that imagination has to our desires. And then I'm going to apply those principles to the problems that Victor's case poses to us. All right, so let's look a little bit more closely at the phenomenon and why it's puzzling. So suppose that we see Patrick in the swimming pool wearing his best suit. Now we're going to assume that there's only two possible explanations of why Patrick is in the swimming pool. Either he's there because some external force impelled him into the pool, so he fell in or somebody pushed him in. Or else he had a motive to jump in. He intentionally jumped in. A motivated agent is acting intentionally on the basis of beliefs and desires. He's seeking to bring about some goal informed by a certain interpretation of reality. For instance, he wanted to save a drowning child, or he wanted to make his friends laugh, or he just wanted to see what it would be like to swim in a swimming pool in a suit. But if Patrick is acting on a motive, if he's acting intentionally toward a goal, then we expect Patrick to be able to tell us what he's doing in the pool and what his goal is, namely, for instance, to save a drowning child. So we assume that the very notion of motivation assumes being conscious of that motivation. If, on the other hand, Patrick tells us, I have no idea why I'm in the pool, I certainly do not want to be in the pool, then we're going to start looking for other explanations besides intentional type motivations. We'll assume that he was pushed, or he tripped, or he had a convulsion, or struck by lightning, or some other reason to explain his being in the pool. So it looks, on the first analysis, as though motivated action has to be conscious action. Now, of course, and I want to make this very clear because this is a very important point, motives don't have to be explicitly conscious. They could also be implicitly conscious. We can act on them without articulating them to ourselves attentively in the moment that we are performing the action. So we can imagine Patrick jumps into the pool to save a drowning child, and then afterwards someone says, wow, that was a very heroic act. And he might say, well, I didn't even really think about it. I just acted on instinct. I just saw the child and I jumped into the pool. However, in the moment that he's performing the action, it's an action that makes sense to him. even if he hasn't articulated to himself fully the kind of deliberative process leading up to jumping into the pool. So saving the child is his implicit goal. It's there in his consciousness, informing his action, and he can immediately pick up on it when someone asks him what he was doing. Well, of course, I was trying to save the child. So he doesn't feel as though he learned anything new about himself if he later says, yes, I'm in the pool because I was trying to save the child. So the very notion of a totally unconscious motivation, at first glance, seems incoherent. And this is one of the most vehement early objections to Freudian psychology. Freud's opponents argued that there's just two accounts. Either you're acting in a motivated way, in which case you're conscious of the goal that you're trying to achieve, or you're moved by a kind of brute impulse or brute drive, either internally or externally. So we can see how surprising and controversial Freud's claim is. What he's claiming is that there's some third option between explicit or implicit conscious motives and raw biological urges. He's identifying something that he wants to call unconscious motives. So these are sub-rational but still cognitive interpretations and expectations that control how things appear to us. So if anybody's ever read the works of Jonathan Lear, who's a practicing psychoanalyst as well as a philosopher who writes wonderfully on Freud and many other figures in the history of philosophy as well. And the way he puts it is that Freud's unconscious is, quote, not merely a hidden and recalcitrant realm of desire, but an alternative, non-rational form of mindedness. And he gives a particularly illuminating example from his own psychoanalytic practice with someone he calls Ms. A, who consciously experienced herself as the victim of an unending series of disappointments without being aware that she was, quote, inflicting the painful disappointment on herself by interpreting each event to support an overarching narrative that life shall be disappointing. She's doing something to the events that show up, to interpret the events that show up to her, but she's not aware of herself as having any control over how things appear. She just thinks that things are, in fact, disappointing and reality is out to get her. Although Ms. A is not conscious of the narrative, it was a narrative nonetheless, and this is a really important point, providing an interpretive framework, so not just a raw desire, but an interpretive framework for her to unify her experiences in a way that made sense of them. So Lear explains, and I think I put this quote on your handout, quote, this gives us a plausible way to understand the psychic determinism of unconscious mental life. The point ought not to be that there will always be a hidden antecedent mental cause determining the will, but that disappointment functions as a formal cause, casting an aura over the events that do occur and providing them with a misleading and unhappy-making interpretation. We can have confidence in thinking that however this chain of events happens and however it comes about, there will be a tendency to incorporate it into an interpretive frame in which a sense of disappointment rules. So the cases of Victor or Ms. A illustrate a central pillar of Freud's thought and one that I think we have to take seriously, namely that the internal causes of our actions are not merely reducible to inchoate drives or urges plus conscious goals, but also something else, non-rational psychological frameworks that inform and constrain our conscious judgments, but are not implicitly or explicitly accessible within consciousness. So this is what I'm going to call non-rational psychological frameworks, or pre-rational interpretive frameworks. They've changed the language slightly on the handout. Now, these pre-rational interpretive frameworks are interpreted by Freud as being unconscious motives. So he distinguishes within the human psyche an unconscious realm which operates motivationally. It has its own interpretations of reality and its own desires in accord with those interpretations. But those unconscious motives can't be discovered simply by reflecting on ourselves in the ordinary way. And again, as Lear puts it, the voice of the unconscious does not normally make itself heard in our conscious life. And this is what the strategy of psychoanalysis is supposed to do. It's supposed to find a way of letting the unconscious, the voice of the unconscious, bubble up into our conscious life through these famous Freudian slips. All right. But is it necessary to posit a realm of unconscious motives in order to explain cases like Victor and Ms. A? I don't think so, and in the remainder of the paper, I'm going to explore how the tendencies of imagination in Aquinas provides an interesting alternative. So now let's turn to Aquinas. And Aquinas is interesting, I think, as a potential contributor to this discussion of this phenomenon, precisely because he's one of the key figures in his tradition to reject the possibility of any unconscious mental activity. So if we think the idea of an unconscious entered the discussion with Freud, that's incorrect. This is a very old idea. It goes back a very long way. You can see it in Avicenna, for instance. It's one of the key figures in the medieval tradition. And many medieval thinkers also take up the idea that you can have parts of the soul, parts of the intellect that are acting all the time, beholding the divine ideas, for instance, or the soul beholding itself. There's certain kinds of activities that are just happening but not consciously accessible to us. So that's a common view, and one Aquinas was certainly very familiar with in his time. But he thinks, and we can talk during the Q&A about why he thinks this, but he thinks that this is actually an incoherent way of talking about human cognitive activity. Specifically. So he thinks that for human beings, not for angels or gods, but God, but specifically for human beings, our cognitive life is always conscious. So we have all of our desires, our judgments, our grasps of reality, our imaginings, our perceptions are always conscious activities. And they don't have to be necessarily explicitly conscious, but they are at least implicitly conscious. So in the cognitive realm, as a result, for Aquinas, there's only ever two possibilities. Either you're performing some kind of mental activity, desiring, judging, believing, apprehending, perceiving. Those acts are always conscious acts. Or we could be talking about mental dispositions. So a mental disposition is going to be some kind of structure in the human being, like a habit or a virtue or a form of some sort, that's a kind of precondition that shapes the way you act in a particular way. Now, those are not in any way a kind of mental activity. They're not a kind of unconscious activity, but they're a kind of structure that's in us that changes the way that we act. It fits our actions into a certain mold. So the way to think about this perhaps would be by analogy to running. So in order to be a good runner, you need to have certain dispositions of your muscles, let's say muscle tone, right, which will then enable you to act running in a particular way, swiftly or with great stamina. So there's something analogous to that psychologically where we have these kind of mental dispositions that enable us to act a certain way. So for instance, the habit of knowing geometry or the virtue of prudence, or these are sort of commonly known dispositions. Well, part of what I'm going to argue is that there's other kinds of dispositions that we don't really talk about very much that are also extremely interesting. All right. Now, in order to understand a little bit about where the imagination fits in Aquinas' psychology, I gave you a little diagram on the handout. This is very much simplified. Again, I'm trying to sort of present this in a way that would be accessible even if you're not familiar with Aquinas' psychology. So if you want more technical detail, again, we can talk about that in the Q&A. So just know this is a sort of more general overview. So if we imagine a person encountering a horse, for Aquinas, there's three cognitive levels that the human being is operating at. The lowest level is the level of the external senses. So this is sight, sound, touch, taste, smell. And these external senses are picking up raw sensory information about the horse. Of course, that information has to be organized in some way. And it's all the organizing work is done at the level of the internal senses. And these are powers of the brain. They're physical powers of the brain for Aquinas. And I'm going to talk about in detail about how that goes in just one second, but just to get the big picture. And then from the imagination is responsible for structuring and organizing our experience, letting us pick out these kinds of individuals in our experience. So the fact that if I look and I see this horse, I'm able to pick it out from its background, that's the work of the inner senses. But then, as a human being, I also have an insight into this creature as something belonging to a particular kind. So even if I don't have a clear notion of horseness in the way that a zoologist does, still, when I encounter this particular animal, I'm able to grasp it as somehow knowable. I'm able to have insight into it on the level of its intelligibility. I'm able to ask questions about what it is. And that's all done at the level of intellect. And that's the specifically human characteristic, the one that other animals don't have for Aquinas. Okay, so let's step. Usually people go straight from perception, gloss quickly over the imagination, and then go into the intellect where the interesting, especially human stuff is happening. I think we should spend a little bit more time on those internal senses, which are the powers of the brain. So let's take a closer look at those. For Aquinas, there's four internal senses. And I'm going to bundle the last three together under the name imagination. He's actually very loose in his terminology here. And so we can use the language of imagination to talk about a group of them that plays a very important role. The last three. So the first thing that has to happen when you get all this raw sensory data coming in through the five senses, the first thing that has to happen is that they need to get bundled into a single sensory manifold. And so the idea is that you've got five separate streams and they need to all come together into a single stream. And that's done by what Aquinas calls this common sense. It's a kind of unification of our different sensory impressions. Once you have that, and you can imagine what that's like, it's just a kind of raw smash of data into your awareness. There's a process that has to happen of differentiating and picking out individuals within that raw field of color, shape, sound, texture, smell. And for Aquinas, this is done by the three powers that we're going to talk about tonight as being the imagination, which break down into the imaginative power, the estimative or cogitative power, and the memorative power. And basically, these are responsible for doing things like detecting motion, giving you your sense of temporal duration. So if you feel like you've been sitting here for a really long time listening to this talk, that's your imaginative power kicking in and giving you that sense of duration, because that's not something that's just there already in the deliverance of your external senses. You also have some sort of sense of what's to be pursued and what's to be avoided, so things show up to you as threatening or beneficial, and we're going to talk more about that in a minute. That Aquinas particularly identifies with the work of the estimative or cogitative power. And then you also have memory, which is remembering and recalling those distinct impressions of individuals. So basically what's happening is that between the raw external sensation and the intellect, an enormous amount of work is being done to give you the kind of experience that you're having right now, where you look, or I'm looking out into a room where there's a lot of discrete individuals. It's not just a giant mass of confused color, but I can pick out distinct individual, chair, person, and recognize patterns within that visual frame and differentiate depth and persistence of individuals in time. And that's all, that work is all being done by these internal senses. So they're very important for Aquinas. So let's talk a little bit more about some special features that imagination, again, using that as a term for these three imaginative, estimative, and memorative powers. some special features that they have for our purpose. And what I'm going to do actually is to focus particularly on how Aquinas says this works in non-human animals. And the reason is that he thinks that once rationality kicks in, once the child reaches the age of reason and the intellect starts to become part of their mental life, the activity of intellect begins to fundamentally alter the way that imagination works. There's a kind of interference and reshaping of the functioning of imagination. So if we want to sort of get a sense of what it does in its pure form, we have to look to non-human animals. We could look at what he says about children, but unfortunately there's almost nothing that he says about children. So the best thing to do is to look at non-human animals as a correlate. And that's also helpful, I think, in placing him in conversation with Freud, because a lot of the ways that the imagination get formed precisely happen when we're children. Okay, so imagination in Aquinas has two important features for our purposes. First, it's pattern sensitive. So imagination is what enables the human or animal child to begin picking out individuals within the field of sensory data and then re-identifying them again later. So imagination is able to do this because it tracks and stores patterns and therefore creates expectations for how things are going to go when that pattern crops up again. So for instance, you can picture a baby lamb. The baby lamb's imagination has to begin to differentiate shapes within its environment. And the repetition of a shape that the imagination begins to pick out over and over is what eventually lets it begin to identify this sheep-shaped thing as something distinct from the other things. Something distinct from the background. So it's able to pull an individual out from the background by re-identifying a pattern over and over again. So you can imagine the little lamb with its little imagination working overtime, and it's differentiating all sorts of things within its environment. So the mother sheep, other sheep, the grass, the trees, the wolf, very important. So all kinds of things within its environment, and this is done by constantly picking out the patterns within the sensory manifold. So for Aquinas, these structures that the animal begins to pick out with its imagination are really there in the real world. So when we talk about imagination structuring our experience and picking out individuals, it might begin to seem like Aquinas is going to have some sort of Kantian view where we're constructing our experience. And in a way, there's something partially true to that and something not true to that comparison, and we can talk about that more again during the Q&A, but I'm going to use the language of structuring in a quasi-ambiguous way to talk about what the imagination is doing without trying to give the impression that there isn't anything there in reality to correspond to those structures. All right. Second, and this is crucial for our purposes, the patterns to which imagination is responsive are always action-relevant patterns. So Aquinas writes that higher animals always perceive objects in their environment as action relevant, as the goal or cause of some action or passion. So he says the sheep knows the lamb not as a lamb. Of course, it can't. It would need an intellect to do that. It would have to pick out the nature of the thing. But rather as suitable to nurse. So the way that animals grasp objects in their environment is as suitable or unsuitable for particular actions that the animal needs to perform in order to survive. So the sheep grasps the grass, again, not as grass, but as suitable to eat. So you can picture how the animal environment is shaping up, right? Picking out individuals, but each individual is showing up as being the object of a potential action in the environment. All right, so for Aquinas, this means that for both human and non-human animals, the way imagination presents objects is always preloaded with some sort of desire or fear connotation, with some sort of notion of benefit, suitability, or threat something to be avoided. So he says, quote, "The apprehension of a sensible object does not cause an emotion unless it be apprehended under the aspect of suitable or unsuitable." And he gives the example of the sheep fleeing the wolf and following its mother because it apprehends the wolf as unfitting, unsuitable to it, and the mother as suitable to it. So, in other words, the sheep's structuring of experience is not neutral to emotions, such as desire or fear or anger. Imagination is already presenting the mother sheep as appealing, which is precisely why the lamb wants to follow the mother. So the desire follows because the imagination has already structured a kind of tendency toward, an inclination toward, the mother as being suitable for the sheep, the lamb, sorry. Conversely, the lamb's imagination presents to it the wolf as threatening already, which is why the wolf begins to run away from it. So these impelling and repelling motions are generated precisely because of the way the imagination is construing or presenting an object. So what does this mean? It means that for Aquinas, when imagination is detecting patterns, it's structuring our experience of those patterned objects in such a way that those objects appear to us already as being appealing or threatening. And that's going to help us understand how powerful of a role that imagination can play in our psychological lives. This is the guiding force of a non-human animal's life, of a very small child's life, and it continues to play a very important role in our adult life. So let's make some three important observations. These are summarized, I think, on the back of your handout. There's three important observations here that I think we can make about this theory that are going to help us to put it into conversation with the phenomenon that Freud brings to our attention. So first of all, it's important to realize that for Aquinas, the attractive or repellent character that generates animal desire and fear does not attach to objects as this particular object, but only as instances of a pattern or members of a class. So what he says, and this is kind of a lovely phrase, sheep hates wolf generally. So the problem that a sheep has with this wolf is not its being this creature, but just that it shows up as instantiating a kind of pattern to the sheep. And that pattern is perceived by the sheep as threatening. So this is important because it implies that attraction and repulsion at this imaginative level is operating with patterns or generalities and not with this or that particular individual as such. So similar objects that fit the pattern, are going to be experienced as similarly attractive or similarly repulsive. Second thing to notice, appeal and threat are part of the way that imagination presents objects in our environment. They're part of the interpretation or construal of objects in our environment. And I think this is actually a very interesting point in Aquinas' theory of imagination. We could think, and I think we have a tendency to think, first you have a construal, and then following that, you have an emotional response. Because we've got two things, first the cognition, then the emotion, two different events. And I think in Aquinas, he actually sees these as just two sides of the same experience. You have one, let's say, cognitive affective attitude toward this object. And the cognitive side of it is grasping the object as attractive. And the emotional side of it is the movement of your appetite toward that object. So this would happen, of course, if I were presented with chocolate. I would see it and it would show up to me as desirable, but the other side of appearing desirable to me would be an emotion of desire impelling me toward that object, and then perhaps I would begin to move toward the chocolate. but they're really just two sides of the same experience. Third key point here. Aquinas noticed, and I shouldn't say Aquinas noticed because he didn't go out into the field and start noticing these things. His sources noticed, and Aquinas repeats, so this is Arabic sources in particular, and then Aquinas repeats them, that different animals find different things appealing and repelling. So the sheep is afraid of the wolf, but baby wolves are not afraid of other wolves, right? So the reason, he says, for the differentiation, the reason why some animal imaginations perceive an object, the same object, as attractive, that other animals perceive as repellent, usually when he's trying to explain that, he'll say the reason is the animal's nature. So each animal has its own biological structure. It belongs to a particular species, and therefore it has a species-specific imagination. This is, remember, the imagination's in the brain. Right, so the brain is structured a particular way, and as a result, the animal is sort of pre-wired to pick out certain kinds of individuals as threatening or attractive. But he also points out that that certain kinds of animals, at least, are able to be taught through experience, and they can acquire new he calls these dispositions, or accustomations of the imagination, that change or reshape how they perceive certain objects as attractive or repulsive. So here's a text where he says this, and this is from De Veritate, it's on your handout. He says, humans, just as much as brute animals, are induced to act through favors and deterrents, literally whips in the Latin, or commands and prohibitions, but in different ways. For it's in the power of humans to choose or flee by the judgment of reason the very same things similarly presented. He's thinking of adults here. But in brutes there is a natural judgment determined so that what is proposed or occurs in one way will be received or avoided in the same way. But it happens that from the memory of previous favors or deterrents that brute animals apprehend something as friendly, to be followed or expected, and something else as inimical, to be fled from or feared. And therefore, after the deterrent, from the passion of fear which arises in them, they're induced to obey the signal of the instructor. And he thinks that this is not something that non-human animals do on account of free will, but because they're open to multiple different kinds of actions, but not can't freely choose among them. So the idea is that when a certain experience is repeated in memory, and remember that the imagination detects patterns, so if part of the pattern that the animal comes to detect is incorporated with an emotion of fear, right, then the animal is going to begin to respond to or present imaginatively things conforming to that pattern as being fearful. or similarly attractive. So we can think about, for instance, training a dog to hunt grouse. But on Aquinas' account, what the trainer is doing is inducing in the dog a new structure of imagination, a new disposition or tendency of imagination to present grouse differently from the way the dog would ordinarily. The dog's imagination would ordinarily present grouse. So normally the dog would perceive grouse as to be eaten. But as the result of training, now the dog's imagination presents grouse as to be brought to the hunter. So the inclinations of the imagination have been altered in the dog. And Aquinas talks about this as a becoming accustomed, consuetudo, or a new disposition that's acquired, a kind of new mold in the imagination to put our experience into. All right. So far I've mentioned that activities of imagination are all Aquinas' cognitive activities are conscious activities. So that includes activities of imagination. So any desire that or presentation of imagination for Aquinas occurs in consciousness. It's not something that's subconscious or preconscious or unconscious. It's part of the animal's conscious life or the human's conscious life. But the dispositions, the accustomations, the frameworks or structures of imagination that cause things to be presented to us in a particular way, those for Aquinas are not part of our conscious life, and they're not consciously accessible to us. He thinks that this, he talks about this a lot when he's talking about how we come to moral self-knowledge. So he thinks that, for instance, when David sees Goliath, if he's suddenly impelled, he feels this sudden impulse to run away, he's not going to know whether that comes from a disposition of prudence or a disposition of cowardice. All that David can be conscious of is the impulse to flee. And the only way that he's going to be able to know what disposition caused that impulse to arise in the way that it did is by reasoning. He's never going to have first-person access to the disposition itself. He can only reason, well, when I find myself in scary situations, I always feel impelled to flee. I wonder if that means I'm a cowardly person. And then he might have to go talk to someone and try to learn a little bit more about courage and cowardice to try to figure out, is that actually cowardice? Does that fit what I know of cowardice? So this is an important point then, because it means that we've got something in us that structures imagination to present objects in our environment a particular way that we can't actually access in our conscious life. But we can only reason and try to infer what it might be. All right. Oh, there we go. Okay, so the upshot is this. On Aquinas' account, we have no internal experiential access to whatever it is that causes our presentations of imagination to be the way they are. We can be aware of feeling impelled toward or away something from something, but we don't internally feel something in us structuring our experience of reality. We're not aware of doing anything or having any sort of role in the way that things appear to us. So now let's come back to Victor and see how his particular case might be evaluated using Aquinas' psychological framework. But Victor's case is particularly complicated. So I want to test drive this by trying it out on another case. Let's say Victor's twin sister, Victorina, who has a similar problem, similar pattern of vacation avoidance, but I think can be accounted for in a slightly easier way. So, unfortunately, Victor and Victorina's mother was a workaholic who became anxious away from work and spent their family vacations in a tense and quarrelsome mood. Young Victorina's imagination, therefore, acquired a disposition to structure current experiences of vacations or presentations of possible vacations as threatening. So now when Victorina takes a relaxing trip with her friends, she can't escape the constant feeling of being on edge. Her imagination is just used to structuring experiences that fit a certain pattern in fear-inducing or threatening terms, even when there's no present cause for fear. She's just not used to presenting these experiences any other way. Now, the reason that Victorina's case is easier is that she at least experiences herself as disinclined to go on vacation. So when her friends invite her on a trip, she says, oh, it's just too hard to pack everything up. The weather's going to be bad. I hate sleeping in strange hotels. I'll never get the time off. I just don't really want to go. So she's aware of being disinclined to this present proposal to travel, and her judgments even express reasons for that disinclination. Not the underlying reason, they're the reasons that she has. The disinclination she feels when presented with travel plans is already there in her conscious awareness. And so what we can say she lacks is the intellectual articulation of this pattern of vacation avoidance. So what she has never noticed is that the disinclination that she's experiencing right now is just one in a long series of what begins to look, if we look at them all together, as a kind of suspicious pattern. She's never noticed the trend. This is something that the intellect should be able to pick up. That she feels disfavorably about vacations as such. Perhaps in therapy, she might come to recognize the pattern and recognize that there's something unusual about feeling this way about experiences that are normally supposed to be enjoyable. But the point is that her feeling of disinclination toward a particular travel plan is a conscious feeling and one that in principle she ought to be able to notice. But Victor's case is much more difficult because Victor experiences himself as wanting to go on vacation, and he's legitimately disappointed when, as it seems, his travel plans keep getting frustrated out of the blue. He's even surprised when his wife accuses him of not wanting to go on vacation. So assuming that he's not simply the much maligned victim of a whole string of bad luck events, it seems that some psychological factor must be at work. And here's where I think Aquinas has something really interesting to say about the case. Because given what we have seen of Aquinas' theory of imagination and consciousness, we have to conclude that Victor is right when he says he wants to go on vacation. For Aquinas, there's no secret desire in there for him to somehow be able to dig through and look for. The desire that he has is a desire to go on vacation. So Victor's imagination must be structuring the presentation of possible future vacations to him in attractive terms. Otherwise, he would not look forward to the vacation, and he would not feel disappointment when the plan falls through. So if an imaginative disposition is at work here, it can't be the one that, like Victorina's, structures the vacation-related experiences in disinclining terms. Instead, I think a different imaginative disposition could account for Victor's suspiciously consistent vacation avoidance. In order to explain his behavior, it's not necessary that he consistently present to himself vacations as disinclining. It's only necessary that he consistently present the alternative to a vacation as overwhelmingly desirable whenever there's an alternative comes up. So these alternatives are presented to him as so attractive that he always feels compelled to cancel his plans, regretfully, to accommodate this very compelling alternative. So the profile, we can imagine what the profile for this imaginative disposition might be. It controls how two goods, work and relaxation, are perceived in relation to each other. And maybe these presentations only kick in when the vacation actually seems within reach. So the imagination can work in highly sophisticated ways for Aquinas, and this is sensitive to a lot of different patterns. Such a disposition is perhaps formed by some pattern of negative feedback that accustoms him to experiencing the dutiful alternative as overwhelmingly attractive whenever it comes into competition with a relaxing alternative. And this is interesting because it might mean that if Victor is supposed to be thinking about, he'd be sorting through his memories, looking for unpleasant family vacations that he might have had, maybe that's actually not the problem. The problem might be the way that he presents to himself the dutiful and the relaxing. And he has this kind of tendency to present the dutiful as always overwhelmingly more attractive than the relaxing when the two come in competition. All right, so if this analysis is correct, then we can see that it would be unfair to accuse Victor of secretly wanting to avoid vacation. He has no disinclination toward vacation. If he did, it would be conscious and could be brought to his attention. And we can notice this pattern is precisely what makes it so difficult for Victor to discover what's going on, as opposed to Victorina, where it's a lot easier to deal with the situation. Since the inclination always aligns with a real reason that makes postponing the vacation intelligible, Victor can always cite some reason to justify the postponement. Well, of course, the roof needs to be redone. The employee has to be trained. Maybe he even intellectually recognizes that there's a kind of pattern here, but he can interpret it in self-flattering terms as evidence of his own self-sacrifice and dedication to his job. And so the pathology resists discovery. The true nature of the imaginative disposition structuring these inclinations remains unknown. Okay, in conclusion then, why is it interesting or important that Aquinas' psychology makes room for Freud's signature observations about human pathology? I think some of the interest, of course, is historical because Aquinas has this resistance to an idea of any sort of unconscious mental activity, and so it's interesting to see that we can do something with his theory of imagination to deal with these kinds of very sophisticated phenomena. And I think there's also, in historical terms, we could see the damaging effect, perhaps, of Aristotle's division of the human psyche into the rational and then the non-rational, which he identifies with the appetitive. There's a tendency to talk about the rational and then separate it off from desire as being sort of two different things. and that can often lead to thinking about the only frameworks, interpretive frameworks that we have as always being rational frameworks. And I think in Aquinas we see, and this is, I think, an authentically Aristotelian interpretation from the De Anima, but not from the Nicomachean Ethics, that the imagination is itself a kind of interpretive framework. Some of the interpretive frameworks we have are not just rational, they're also sub-rational, and that's part of what the imagination is supposed to be doing. But there's three systematic psychological reasons, I think, to be interested in approach to the phenomenon along the lines of what Aquinas can offer. So first, we get the idea in Aquinas of a non-rational mindedness between mere disposition and rational evaluation. And so Aquinas' approach honors the specifically cognitive dimension of this phenomenon without having to appeal to an unconscious. Secondly, I think there would be interestingly different therapeutic strategies that might be cashed out from thinking about this phenomenon in the different ways that Freud gives us as opposed to what Aquinas gives us. So on the popularized two-realm view, the sort of Freudian notion, you've got the conscious and the unconscious, and you have to let the unconscious speak, what you need to do is to find out what you secretly believe or secretly desire and bring that to light. But on Aquinas' view, then this would be a kind of waste of time because there are no secret desires or beliefs. What there are patterns of structuring the objects in our environment in particular ways as threatening or attractive. And so I think from Aquinas' perspective, the approach to take would be one of looking for patterns in our responses to similar situation and then to seek wise assistance in reasoning about why the imagination might in fact be presenting situations in that way and whether those presentations are in fact appropriate to the situations at hand. And I think there's probably some parallels here with cognitive behavioral therapy. And then lastly, I think there's an interesting role here to talk about the relationship of imagination and intellect as having a role of potentially obscuring what the imagination is doing by incorrectly interpreting, reflecting on these presentations of imagination, and incorrectly interpreting them, and thus making them resistant to true self-knowledge, or as reflecting on the imagination and correctly interpreting, and therefore giving us more insight about why we behave in certain ways in our imaginative life. So one thing that the intellect can do then is be part of the process of reordering imaginative presentations in such a way as to promote the formation of new, more realistic, and psychologically healthier imaginative dispositions. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.